the South were relentless and put the young kingdom in a constant state of war.
Sounds familiar.
Nikolai knew this story from his own childhood classrooms. He'd always found it disheartening that Ravka had been at war since birth.
There was no Second Army then, Yori continued. Ravka's soldiers fought and died, just as other men did. But as the legend goes, Yaromir built an altar atop a hill in Osalta.
The site of the first royal chapel, said Tolia.
Yori nodded. The young king prayed to all of the saints who would hear him. And the next day, a group of monks arrived at his door and offered to fight by his side. They were not ordinary monks. When they went into battle, they could take on the shapes of beasts. They fought not as men, but as all manner of creature. Wolf, dragon, hawk, bear. The king had heard stories of these monks, but hardly believed they were true until he saw these miracles for himself.
Always with the miracles, grumbled Zoya.
Yes, said Yori, opening his eyes, fervor burning in them like a brand. Always. The monks agreed to fight for the king. They asked for neither gold nor land, but only that one of them would always remain at the king's side, so that Ravka would forever be devoted to the worship of the saints. The monks plunged into battle and sent the enemies of Ravka scattering, pushing them back and forming the borders that would hold, more or less, for thousands of years. Yori's voice rose, caught in the telling of his tale, all hesitation gone. But the battle lasted so long that when it was over, and it was time for them to return to their human forms, they could not. Their leader brought them to the site of an ancient thornwood, and there they endured a dangerous ritual. The Obispaya. Those who survived became men once more, and their leader took his place beside Yaromir. Eventually, the priest who held the office closest to the king was given the title of Apparat, and the holy soldiers that surrounded him became the priest guard.
Some people claim the first priest guard were Grisha, said Tolia.
Tamar touched her fingers to the shark's tooth at her neck. In that version, the animals they became were the first amplifiers. Their spirits made the monk's power stronger.
Nikolai studied Yori. The story was strange, no doubt, and likely more fiction than fact.
Even so.
A ritual to purge beast from man? What exactly did it entail?
Yori pushed his spectacles up his nose, the confident scholar vanishing with a single gesture.
I'm not sure. There are conflicting texts.
You're not really a firebrand, are you, Yori?
A smile touched the monk's lips.
I suppose not.
And yet you ended up at my gates, calling me a traitor and a thief.
Yori at least had the manners to squirm.
What brought you there?
The saints. I believe that.
Nikolai had his doubts.
Tell me about this ritual.
Why?
Yori asked, brow furrowing.
I am a king. I long for entertainment.
The monk tugged on his scraggly beard.
I don't know the details. There are conflicting accounts in the texts, and I'm no longer permitted.
They're religious texts, aren't they?
Nikolai said.
From the priest guard's library. You don't have access anymore.
No.
The ache in his voice was palpable. Nikolai thought he understood. There had been a time when words had been the only place he could find solace. No book ever lost patience with him or told him to sit still. When his tutors had thrown up their hands in frustration, it was the library that had taught Nikolai military history, strategy, chemistry, astronomy. Each spine had been an open doorway whispering, "Come in, come in. Here is a land you've never seen before. Here is a place to hide when you're frightened, to play when you're bored, to rest when the world seems unkind." Yori knew that solace. He had once been a scholar. Perhaps he'd like to be one again. Nikolai stood.
Thank you, Yori. You've been most helpful.
The monk rose slowly.
I have? Then will you lend your name to our plea, Your Highness? The apparat cannot ignore the voice of the king. If you would petition him to—
I will think on it, Yori. You've made an interesting argument. For now, I will have you escorted back to your rooms.
Then I am a prisoner still?
You are a welcome guest who I don't want to stray too far. And perhaps I can get you access to some reading materials.
Yori paused as if uncertain he'd heard correctly.
My books?
Perhaps.
That would be— No, I must return to my fellow worshippers outside the city. You cannot keep—
And you will. But we must ask that you enjoy our hospitality a short while longer, while we consider the merits of your case.
Yuri's chin lifted.
For the Starless One, I can wait an eternity. But do not play games with me, Your Highness. I did not come to the capital to be laughed at, or to dilly-dally about.
Dally, yes. Dilly, no, said Nikolai.
Gave it up in my youth.
Zoya rolled her eyes, and Tolia shuffled Yuri out the door and into the care of two palace guards. When Yuri was gone, Nikolai rose to look more closely at the pins on the map. In the wake of the monk's departure, the silence in the room felt heavy, as if another presence had entered the chamber. Something old and nameless.
The boy is mad, said Zoya.
He's a believer, said Tolia. Those aren't the same thing.
And I'd rather a true believer than a man like the apparat, Jenya added.
How can you say that? Said Zoya. He worships a tyrant, a murderer, the man who tortured you.
Jenya sighed. Can we blame him for being drawn to the Darkling's strength?
We all were. We didn't know what he was then.
Didn't we? Jenya adjusted her eye patch. Yuri is a frightened boy looking for something bigger than himself to give his life meaning. There are people like him all over Ravka. That's what worries me.
Tolia sat down beside his sister, and Nikolai caught the look that passed between them. This was not the time to start keeping secrets.
What is it?
Tolia heaved his great shoulders.
There may be something to Yuri's story. The priest guard weren't always just lackeys for the apparat. They were holy warriors who served the crown as well. When I was younger, I wanted nothing more than to join them.
What stopped you? Nikolai asked.
He wasn't surprised exactly. Both Tolia and Tamar had been raised in the church, and he was well aware that if Alina Starkov hadn't given Nikolai her blessing as king, the twins would never have pledged themselves as his guards.
They wouldn't let me join, said Tamar. No women allowed.
Tolia nodded.
I had to question a holy order that claimed to want warriors but would deny a fighter like Tamar.
Tamar rested her hands on her axes. The saints had a different plan for us.
Ah, said Nikolai.
But what do the saints have planned now? Zoya, when I got free from Duke Radimov's estate in Evets, you found me where?
A goose farm on the road to Varena.
Nikolai touched his finger to the map.
A northeastern path. But every time I've gotten loose from the palace, I've headed northwest. Each time I've taken the same route, just gone a little farther.
What if the creature is trying to get to that spot on the fold?
What if it wants to be free of me as much as I want to be free of it?
Or what if these supposed miracles are a plan to lure you from the palace? Said Zoya.
To the fold? Why?
Zoya cast up her hands.
I don't know.
The miracles began when the demon woke inside me. It may be connected to the Darkling's power, or Yuri may be talking nonsense, but that pattern is real. Something is happening, and it's connected to this spot on the Shadow Fold.
It's not safe to leave the palace, Zoya protested.
There are no safe places, not anymore.
He'd proven that himself last night.
Jenya will mix me a stronger tonic. David will forge thicker chains. I'm going on a pilgrimage.
To some mythical thornwood, said Zoya. Even if it once existed, the fold obliterated everything in its path. There's nothing there anymore.
Tolia spoke a long string of words, only a few of which Nikolai could pick out. Then he said,
Lost faith is the roots of a forgotten wood, waiting to thrive once more.
Zoya narrowed her eyes. We agreed no poetry during meetings.
It's liturgical, Ravkin,
Tolia objected.
That's from the Book of Alyosha, which you might know if you ever went to church.
It's a wonder I've survived this long without such knowledge.
Tolia, Nikolai interrupted, I'm going to need you to find any texts you can on the Obispaya, and anything connected to it. I don't want Yuri to be the only scholar I can rely on.
I'm not a scholar,
protested Tolia.
You might have been, in another life, said Nikolai.
What do you mean, the only scholar? Zoya said. You can't possibly mean to travel with the monk.
Jenya shifted in her seat. It will look like you're lending support to the cult of the Starless. I don't like the message that sends.
We'll make sure Yuri is disguised, and I don't intend to take a direct route to the fold, said Nikolai.
There may be something we can learn at the other miracle sites, and visiting them will give me an opportunity to walk among my subjects before I choose a bride. We have armies massing at both borders. New Lansoft pretenders cropping up to make claims on the throne. Our coffers are empty, and our allies are few. I cannot afford to lose the support of the common people. We're going to need it in the days to come.
And what if it all leads to nothing? Asked Jenya. What if the Darkling left you with this curse, and there are no answers to be found?
Zoya laid her fingers flat on the table. What if Yuri discovers the truth about the monster?
Then we pray I can silence him and keep this secret long enough to secure Rothka's future. Even without an heir, there may be a way to keep the throne safe and make sure the country isn't left vulnerable.
And what exactly is that? Asked Zoya.
Are you sure you don't want to try trusting me, Zoya?
It's positively intoxicating.
The idea had come to him the previous week when they'd arrived from Count Kerrigan's and had been greeted by Trukin and Isaac. Zoya pursed her lips.
I don't like any of this. There's too much room for disaster.
Nikolai knew that. They were running out of time, and this journey to the fold smacked of desperation. He could not deny the fear that clung to him, the doubt it sowed in his heart. What if his mind unraveled and his will with it? What if he attacked one of his friends again, and there was no one there to stop him? What damage might he unleash on the people he loved? On the world? Nikolai could not deny those fears, but he refused to give in to them. He would not just hand the monster a victory. He turned to the people assembled before him, his advisors, his soldiers, his family. He needed them to believe, if not in Yuri's tales, then in Nikolai himself, the person he had been before the Darkling and the war. He straightened the lapels of his velvet coat and winked.
It's not exciting if nothing can go wrong.
He felt the monster recoil. Action. Decision. In moments like these, he felt almost like his old self. If this thing wanted to claim his soul, Nikolai intended to give it a damn good fight. And that battle began here. Now. With a refusal to relinquish any bit of his spirit to the terror trying to drag him into the dark, he would do what he had always done. He would charge forward and pray that hope might be waiting like the roots of the thornwood, just out of sight. Chapter 10. Nina. Dusk had fallen by the time she pushed to her feet. The sky looked more gray than purple, wounded like a deep bruise, and the air felt moist against her cheeks. Snow had begun to fall in gentle drifts. It didn't stay gentle for long. Nina had never seen a storm come on so fast. The wind blew hard and snow blurred the whole world white. Gruziburia. Even the Ravkins had a name for this wind, the brute. Not for the cold it brought, but for the way it blinded you like a thug in a dirty fight. Nina was torn between trying to follow the sound of the river back to camp and being afraid she might stray too close to the banks and fall in. She trudged on, squinting against the light. At one point, she thought she heard Adric's voice calling to her, glimpsed the bright yellow flag they'd raised above the tent, but a moment later, it was gone.
Stupid, stupid, stupid. She had not been made for such places. Nina wouldn't survive the night without shelter in this weather. She had no choice but to continue on. Then, like a miracle, the wind lifted. The curtains of snow seemed to part, and she saw a dark shape in the distance. The camp.
Adric, she cried.
But as she drew closer, she saw no flag, no tent. Only the swaying bodies of a copse of trees. And in the snow before them, a slight indentation. She'd walked in a circle. She had returned to Matthias's grave.
Well done, Zenik, she sighed.
She was only 18 years old, so why did she feel so tired? Why did everything behind her seem bright and everything before her look bleak? Maybe she hadn't come here to bury Matthias and claim her new purpose. Maybe she'd come here to the ice, to this cold and unforgiving place, to die. There would be no saints to greet her on a brighter shore. Grisha didn't believe in an afterlife. When they died, they returned to the making at the heart of the world. It was a thought that brought her little comfort. Nina turned back toward camp. There was nothing for it but to start marching again. But before she could take a step, she saw them. Five hulking shapes in the snow. Wolves.
Of course, she said. Matthias, your country can kiss my fat Grisha ass.
The wolves prowled around her in a circle, surrounding her, cutting off any route of escape. Low growls rumbled from their chests. Wolves were sacred to the Druskella. Maybe they'd sensed Matthias's presence, or maybe they'd sensed Nina, a Grisha, an enemy. Or maybe they sensed a nice, juicy meal.
Just go, she said in Fjärden. I don't want to hurt you.
I don't want to die. Matthias had been forced to fight wolves during his year at Hellgate. Jell had a strange sense of humor. Nina flexed her fingers, felt her bone daggers ready to be called. They would work as well on an animal as a human. She hurled off her cloak, feeling the cold bite into her, but freeing the bone shard armor at her back. She was a saint surrounded by her relics. Two wolves leapt. Nina's hands shot out and the bone shards flew true, piercing the animal's bodies in two clean, hard strikes. The wolves yelped and landed in the snow, motionless. The sound broke her heart. At least they were clean deaths. In the end, maybe that was all anyone could hope for. But the others were closing in already. There was something odd about the way they moved. Their eyes glowed almost orange, and they hunched and twitched, as if animated by something more than hunger. What was wrong with them? There was no time to think. They lunged. Nina struck out. This time her aim was less sure. One wolf fell, but the other pounced, landing on her with a weight that sent her tumbling into the snow. Its jaws closed over her forearm, pain lancing through her. The wolf stank of something strange. She screamed. Nina heard a loud snarl and knew she was about to die. All those pretty words for Matthias. Who will speak for me? Then, in a blur, something smashed into the body of the wolf, freeing her from its weight. Nina rolled, clutching her bleeding arm to her chest, gasping for air. She plunged her arm into the snow, trying to get the wound clean. Her body started to shake. It was as if the wolf's bite had carried poison. Nina felt a heart-stopping rush go through her. She saw death all around. Matthias's body in the ground below, a graveyard to the north, an outbreak of plague farther on, the entropy of the earth, the decay in everything. The chorus screamed inside her head. She pressed snow to her cheeks, trembling, trying to clear her thoughts, but when she opened her eyes, she wondered if the poison had fractured her mind. Two wolves were fighting in the snow, one gray, the other white and far larger. They rolled, and the white wolf clamped its jaws over the throat of the gray, but did not bite down. At last, the gray slumped and whimpered. The white wolf released its hold, and the smaller wolf recoiled, slinking away, tail tucked between its haunches. The white wolf turned on Nina, blood on its muzzle. The animal was huge and rangy, but it didn't twist or shake the way the grays had. Something had been infecting them. Something that had gotten into Nina's bloodstream. But this creature moved with the natural, unerring grace of wild things. The white wolf stalked toward her. Nina pushed up onto her knees. holding out her hands to ward it off,
reaching for another bone shard with her power.
Then she saw the scar that ran along its yellow eye. Thrasyl? The wolf's ears twitched. Matthias's wolf. It couldn't be. He'd once told her that when a Druskella died, his brothers gave his Isenulf back to the wild. Had Thrasyl come to find the boy he'd loved? To be united with him even in death? Thrasyl, she said gently. The wolf cocked his big head to the side.
Nina heard hoofbeats. Before she could fathom what was happening, a girl rode into the clearing.
Get back, she cried, galloping her horse between Nina and the white wolf. It took Nina a moment to understand what she was seeing, the tall girl from the convent. This time she wore leather trousers and furs, and the reddish-brown tumble of her hair streamed down her back, held away from her face by two long braids. She looked like a warrior queen, a sylph of the ice straight out of Fjordan legend. She raised her rifle. Thrasyl backed away, snarling. No! Nina screamed. She hurled a bone shard at the girl, striking her shoulder. The rifle shot went wide. Run! Nina yelled at Thrasyl in Fjordan. The wolf snapped his jaws as if in argument. Jelkomenden! Nina shouted. Druskella words. Thrasyl huffed once, then turned and loped into the storm, giving her a last betrayed look as if he couldn't believe she'd asked him to abandon a fight. What are you doing? The tall girl demanded, yanking the bone dart from her shoulder and tossing it into the snow. Nina howled her rage. Matthias's wolf. His troublemaker. His Thrasyl had somehow found his way to her, and this blundering podge had driven him off. She seized the girl's leg and yanked her from the saddle. Hey! The girl tried to shove Nina away, clearly surprised by her strength. But Nina had been trained as a soldier. She might not be built like a Fjordan warrior, but she was plenty strong. You scared him away! That was a wolf! The girl shouted back in her face. You know that, right? He already bit you once. Just because he follows some of your commands. He didn't bite me, you ass. It was the other wolf. The other? Are you out of your mind? And how do you know Druskella commands anyway? Nina found hot tears running down her cheeks. She might never see Thrasyl again. What if Matthias had sent him to her, called him here to help her? You had no right! I didn't mean to. It doesn't matter what you meant! Nina stalked toward her. Careless, foolish, thoughtless. She didn't know if she was talking to this girl or herself anymore. And she didn't care. It was all too much. She shoved the other girl hard. Swept her leg behind her ankle. Stop it! Snarled the girl as she toppled. But Nina could not stop. She wanted to get hit. She wanted to hit back. She grabbed the girl by her collar. Nina grunted as sudden pain seized her chest. It felt like a fist around her heart. The girl had her hands up, something between terror and exultation in her copper eyes. Nina felt her body grow heavy, her vision blurred. She knew this feeling from her training as a korporalnik. The other girl was slowing Nina's heartbeat. Grisha, Nina gasped. I don't... Nina pushed her own power against the other girl's, felt her living, vibrant force waver. With the last bit of her strength, Nina flicked her fingers and a bone shard flew from its sheath at her thigh. It struck the girl in the side, not hard. It bounced into the snow. But it was enough to break her concentration. Nina stumbled backward, trying to regain her breath, fingers pressed to her sternum. She hadn't had heartrender power used against her for years. She'd forgotten just how frightening it could be. You're Grisha, she said. The girl leapt to her feet, knife drawn. I'm not. Interesting, thought Nina. She has power, but she can't control it. She trusts the blade more. Nina held up her palms to make peace. I'm not going to hurt you. Now the girl showed no sign of hesitation. Her body was loose, relaxed, as if she felt more herself with steel in her hand. You sure seemed like you wanted to hurt me a second ago. Well, I did, but I've come to my senses. I was trying to save your life. Why do you care about a wolf anyway? You're worse than the Druskella. Now that was something Nina had never expected to hear. That wolf saved me from an attack. I don't know why.
but I didn't want you to hurt him.
This girl was Grisha, and Nina had almost killed her.
I overreacted.
The tall girl shoved her knife back in its sheath.
Overreacting is throwing a tantrum when someone eats the last sweet roll.
She pointed an accusatory finger at Nina.
You are out for blood.
To be fair, I've considered killing over the last sweet roll.
Where's your coat?
I think I took it off, Nina said, searching for an explanation for why she would tear off her coat that didn't involve disclosing her bone armor.
I guess I was going snowmad.
Is that a thing?
Nina found the coat, already almost buried in wet white flakes.
Absolutely. At least in my village.
The other girl rubbed her muscled thigh.
And what did you hit me with?
A dart.
You threw a dart at me? She said incredulously. That's ridiculous.
It worked, didn't it?
A dart made of human bone, but some details were best avoided. And it was time to go on the offensive. Nina shrugged into her damp coat.
You put the guards to sleep at the convent. That's how you sneak out.
All the girl's confidence dissolved, fear dousing her fire like a rogue wave.
I didn't hurt anyone.
But you could have. That's actually very delicate work.
You could land someone in a coma.
The girl stilled as the wind howled around them.
How would you know?
But Nina hadn't spoken without thinking. Grisha power was as good as a death sentence or worse in this country.
My sister was Grisha, Nina lied.
What happened to her?
That's not a story for the middle of a storm.
The girl clenched her fists. Saint, she was tall, but built like a dancer. A long coil of wiry muscle.
You can't tell anyone what I am, she said. They'll kill me.
I'm not going to hurt you, and I'm not going to help anyone hurt you.
The girl's face was wary. The wind rose, keening.
But none of that will matter if we both die out here.
The tall girl looked at Nina as if she really had gone snowmad.
Don't be silly.
You're saying you can find your way through this?
No,
she said, patting her horse's flank.
But Helmut can. There's a hunting lodge not far from here.
Again, she hesitated, and Nina could guess at the thoughts in her head.
You're thinking of leaving me to the mercy of the snow, said Nina.
The girl's eyes slid away guiltily. So she had a merciless streak.
Somehow it made Nina like her more.
I might not survive, but I might.
And then you can be sure I'll tell the first person I meet about the Grisha Heartrender living in secret among the women of the well.
I'm not Grisha.
You do a remarkable imitation. The girl ran a gloved hand through her horse's mane.
Can you ride?
If I have to.
Is that or go to sleep in the snow?
I can ride.
The girl vaulted into the saddle in a single smooth movement. She offered Nina a hand, and Nina let herself be pulled onto the horse's back.
You don't like to skip meals, do you?
Said the girl with a grunt.
Not if I can help it.
Nina settled her hands around the girl's waist, and soon they were moving through the growing drifts.
You can be whipped for using those commands, you know, said the girl. Jel Komenden. That's considered blasphemy if a Druskella isn't speaking. I'll say extra prayers tonight. You never told me how you know those commands.
More lies, then.
A boy from our town served in the ranks.
What's his name?
Nina thought back to the fight at the ice court.
Lars. I believe he passed recently.
And no one wants him back. He'd closed a whip over her and put her on her knees before Kaz Brekker had come calling. The white world stretched on, frozen and featureless. Now that she wasn't walking, Nina felt the cold more deeply, the weight of it settling over her. Just as she began to wonder if the girl knew where she was going, Nina saw a dark shape through the snow, and the horse halted. The girl slid down. Nina followed, her legs gone numb and aching.
and they led Helmut to a sheltered space beside the lodge.
Looks like we aren't the only ones who had this idea, she said.
There were lights in the windows of the little lodge, and she could hear loud voices from within. The other girl twisted the reins in her hands, removing her glove to stroke the horse's nose.
I didn't realize so many people knew about this place. There are probably men inside who came to wait out the storm. We won't be safe here,
Nina considered. Do you have your skirts in your saddlebag? The girl pulled at a knotted belt around her waist, and the folds of her coat dropped into a skirt that fell into place over her trousers. Nina had to admit she was impressed. What other tricks do you have up your sleeve? Or skirts, as the case may be. A smile flickered over her lips.
A few.
The door to the shelter flew open, a man with a gun silhouetted against the light.
Who's out there?
Follow my lead, Nina murmured, then cried.
Oh, thank goodness. We were afraid no one would be here. Hurry, Inger.
Inger? Muttered the girl.
Nina stomped up to the door, ignoring the gun pointed at her, hoping the man holding it wasn't drunk or riled enough to shoot at an unarmed girl. Or a girl who looked unarmed. Nina climbed the steps and smiled sweetly at the big man as the other girl trailed her.
Thank Jell we found shelter for the night.
She glanced over his shoulder into the lodge. The room was crowded with men, 10 at least, all gathered around a fire. Nina felt tension spike through her. This was a moment when she would have been glad to see Druskella, who didn't drink and who were kept to a strict code regarding women. There was nothing to do but brazen it out.
And among gentlemen to protect us.
Who are you?
The man said suspiciously. Nina pushed past him as if she owned the place.
Aren't we lucky, Inger? Let's get in front of that fire and close the door.
She laid a hand on the man's chest.
I'm sorry, what was your name?
He blinked.
Anders.
Be a darling and shut the door, Anders.
They shuffled inside and she met the stares of the man with a smile.
I knew Jell would guide our way, Inger. Surely your father will have a healthy reward in store for all of these fine fellows.
For a moment, the girl looked confused, and Nina thought they might be lost. But then her face cleared.
Yes, yes indeed, my father is most generous when it comes to my safety. And with you, betrothed, to the wealthiest man in Overoot.
Nina winked at the men gathered by the fire.
Well, I suppose Jell has granted you gentlemen a bit of luck this night, too. Now which of you will stand guard for us?
Stand guard,
said a man with tufty orange brows by the fire.
Through the night.
Dumpling, I think you're in a muddle.
Lady Inger's father is most generous, but he cannot be expected to bestow 10,000 krita on every one of you, so you must choose who is to be the beneficiary.
10,000 krita.
That was the price last time, was it not? When we were stranded in that amusing spot down south. Although I suppose now that you are betrothed to the wealthiest man in Overoot, it may be twice the price.
Who is this bridegroom you speak of?
The bearded man asked.
You've heard of Bernard Bola, who made his fortune in smoked trout? And Ingvar Halls, who owns timberland from the Elbjin to the Isenvi?
Well, Lennart Bjord towers above them all.
Lennart Bjord,
the bearded man repeated.
That does sound familiar, said someone by the hearth.
Nina highly doubted that since she'd made him up mere moments ago.
I was the first to greet them, said the big man with the rifle. It's only right I should get the reward. How is that fair? You happen to be by the door.
Now don't get too riled,
Nina said with a schoolmarm tisk in her voice as the men began debating who would take the watch.
Lennart Bjord will have a bit of something for everyone.
Nina and Inger settled in the corner, their backs to the wall as the men argued.
That was pathetic,
the girl seethed, resting her elbows on her knees and tugging her skirt over the toes of her boots.
I beg your pardon?
You made us seem weak. Every time we behave that way, it just makes it easier for men to look at us and see nothing but softness.
There is nothing wrong with softness, Nina said,
her temper fraying. She was exhausted and cold, and she'd dug her lover's grave tonight. Right now they're looking at us as two big bags of money instead of two vulnerable girls alone.
We weren't vulnerable. I have my gun. My knife. You have those ridiculous darts.
Do you also have 12 arms hidden in that coat?
We're outnumbered.
Nina actually suspected that she could have managed all of them, but only if she intended to reveal her true power, and that would mean putting this girl in the ground tonight, too.
They're drunk. We would have managed.
You don't enter a fight you can't win, Nina replied, irritated.
I'm guessing you've had to train in secret, and that you've probably never had a real combat instructor.
Being strong doesn't mean being sloppy. The wiry girl drew her coat closer.
I hate it. I hate how they see us. My father is the same way. He thinks a woman wanting to fight or hunt or fend for herself is unnatural, that it denies men the chance to be protectors.
Nina snorted.
It really is a tragedy for them. What does your mother think?
My mother is the perfect wife, except she provided my father no sons. She does as he dictates. The girl sighed. She looked weary suddenly, the thrill of the fight and the storm gone. Her hair, that extraordinary color, like the woods in autumn, chestnut and red and gold, lay storm damp and tangled against her brown cheeks.
I can't blame her. It's the way the world works.
She's worried I'll become an outcast. So they sent you to a convent in the middle of nowhere?
Where I couldn't get into trouble or embarrass them in front of their friends. Don't pretend you think differently. I saw the way you looked at me when you helped us in the clearing.
You were dressed as a soldier. I was entitled to a little surprise. And she'd been dedicated to maintaining her cover, not befriending a Grisha, one who might be able to get her closer to the factory.
In case you hadn't noticed, I travel on my own, make my own living. That's different. You're a widow.
You needn't sound quite so envious. The girl rubbed her hand over her brow.
I'm sorry. That was thoughtless.
Nina studied her. There was something relentless in her features. The cheekbones sharp, the nose rigorously straight. Only the full thrust of her lips gave any hint of softness. It was a challenging face, stubborn in its lines. Beautiful.
We're not as different as you might think.
Nina bobbed her head toward the men, who were now arm-wrestling for the right to a generous reward that none of them would ever see.
It's fear that makes your father act as he does,
that makes men write foolish rules that say you can't travel alone or ride as you wish to.
The other girl bit back a laugh. Why should they be afraid? The world belongs to them.
But think of all the ways we might achieve if we were allowed to do the things that they do.
If they were truly afraid, you wouldn't have to simper and preen.
Nina winked.
You've seen me simper. If I ever decide to preen, you'll need to sit down for it.
The girl stifled a snort.
I'm Hannah. Nice to meet you, Nina said.
I'm Mila.
She'd told countless lies this night, but somehow it felt wrong to give this girl a false name.
You don't really mean for us to sleep, do you, Mila?
Hannah's face was knowing.
Not a chance. You're going to keep your hand on your dagger, and I'm going to keep first watch.
Nina touched her hand to her sleeve, felt the reassuring presence of the bones lining the fabric. She watched the flickering of the fire.
Rest, she told Hannah, and realized she was smiling for the first time in months.
Chapter 11 Zoya. Preparations for Nikolai's grand tour of the miracle sites required days of planning by the king's staff. Provisions had to be secured, vehicles made ready for the changing weather, appropriate clothing packed, and letters sent to noblemen and governors in the towns they intended to visit. Zoya found herself snapping at everyone even more than usual. She knew the talk was that she was in one of her moods, but the perks of ruling included permission not to slather her words in honey. She did her job. She did it well. If her students and servants and fellow Grisha couldn't endure a few curt replies in exchange, they were in the wrong damn country. She might have been able to relax if everyone didn't move so slowly. But eventually the wagons were packed, the coach prepared, and outriders sent ahead to scout the condition of the roads for the royal procession. The specific itinerary for the trip would be kept secret. But soon Nikolai's people would know their king was traveling, and they would come out in force to see their golden war hero. Zoya wasn't sure what to think of the monk's stories of the Thornwood, or the twins' talk of the priest guard, and the Obispaya. Part of her said that it was foolish to pin their hopes on such a mission, on the ramblings of a fanatic who clearly believed in saints, and all the pomp and nonsense that went with them. She told herself the journey would be good for the crown and Nikolai's standing, regardless of what they found. She told herself that if it all came to nothing, they would find some other way to get through the next few months to appease their allies and keep their enemies at bay. She told herself that the real Nikolai was still in control, not the monster she had seen that night in the bell tower. But Zoya had survived by being honest with herself. And she had to acknowledge that there was another fear lurking inside her. Beneath the anxieties that accompanied the preparations for this journey, beneath the ordeal of looking into the eyes of the demon and seeing its hunger, she was afraid of what they might find on the fold. What if the genuflecting twits who worshipped the Starless One were actually right, and these bizarre occurrences heralded the Darkling's return? What if he somehow found a way back? "This time I'll be ready for him," Zoya whispered the words in the dark, beneath the roof of the chambers the Darkling had once occupied, in the palace he had built from nothing. She wasn't a naive girl anymore, desperately trying to prove herself at every turn. She was a general with a long body count and an even longer memory. "Fear is a phoenix," words Liliana had spoken to her years ago, and that Zoya had repeated to others many times. "You can watch it burn 1,000 times and still it will return." She would not be governed by her fear. She did not have that luxury. "Maybe so," she thought. "But it hasn't kept you from avoiding Nikolai since that night in the bell tower." She hated this frailty in herself, hated that she now kept Tolia or Tamar close when she was chaining the king to his bed at night, that even in meeting rooms she found herself on guard, as if expecting to look across a negotiating table and see his hazel eyes glimmer black. Her fear was useless, unproductive, and she suspected it was something the monster might enjoy. When the morning of their departure finally arrived, she packed a small trunk. Unlike the luggage the servants had prepared for her kefta and traveling clothes, this one would be locked. It held Nikolai's shackles, reinforced twice over and with a new locking mechanism it had taken her hours to master. The weight of them was reassuring in her hands, but she still breathed easier when Jenya and David arrived in her chambers. Zoya peered at the tiny bottle Jenya handed her. It was fitted with a glass stopper. "Is this enough?" "More than enough," said Jenya. "Give him one drop immediately before sleep. A second if you have any trouble. Any more than that? And there's a good chance you'll kill him." "Good to know. Regicide isn't on my list of preferred crimes." Jenya's lips twitched in a smile. "You're saying you've never wanted to kill Nikolai?" "Oh, I have. I just don't want him to sleep through it." Jenya gave her another bottle, this one round and red. "Use this to wake him in the morning. Just uncork it and place it beneath his nose." "What is it, exactly?" "A distillation of Jurda and ammonia. Basically a very fast-acting stimulant."
"That isn't exact at all," said David. "It utilizes..."
Zoya held up a hand.
"Exact enough."
Jenya ran her fingers over the carved surface of the trunk. "The process won't be easy on him. It will be a bit like drowning every night and being revived every morning." Zoya wrapped the bottles in cotton and placed them gently in the trunk, but as she moved to lock the lid, Jenya laid a hand over hers. "We've made the sedative as strong as possible," she said. "But we don't really understand what we're trying to control.
Zoya, you may not be safe with him.
Zoya knew that better than anyone. She'd seen the horror that lurked inside Nikolai too closely to deny it.
What would you suggest I do?
To Zoya's surprise, Jenya said,
I could go.
David pressed his lips into a hard line, and Zoya knew that they'd discussed it, that Jenya meant it. An unwelcome lump rose in her throat, but all she did was raise a brow.
Because you're so good in a fight?
Nikolai needs warriors with him.
The Nichevoya left their mark on me too, Zoya. I understand the pull of this darkness.
Zoya shook her head and drew her hand away, pocketing the key. You aren't prepared for this kind of fight. A knock came and they turned to see Tolia's massive frame filling the doorway to the common room.
The coach is ready, he called back over his shoulder. And Tamar is late.
I am not late, said Tamar from behind him. My wife is just in a sulk. Zoya peered past Tolia's shoulder and saw Tamar holding Nadia's hand, clearly trying to coax her out of her gloom.
I have every right to a sulk, Nadia said. You're leaving. My brother is somewhere in Fierda, and I'm being asked to build a prototype of a submersible that doesn't work for a party I don't want to attend.
I'll be back before you know it, said Tamar. And I'll bring you a present.
It had better be new goggles, said Nadia.
I was thinking of something more romantic. David frowned.
What's more romantic than goggles?
We're ready, said Zoya.
She handed Tolia the trunk.
Jenya, report to me frequently on the replies we receive from the hopefuls and the preparations for security.
I'll send messages through our network on the road. She hesitated. She had the awful urge to hug Jenya. And for once she indulged it. She felt Tolia's disbelieving stare, felt Jenya stiffen in surprise, then hug her back.
Be safe, Zoya whispered.
Be safe, as if those words could cast some kind of spell.
The only danger to me will be an overabundance of menu planning, said Jenya with a laugh.
She drew back, and Zoya was both horrified and touched to see tears in Jenya's amber eye.
Do you really believe a cure is possible?
I have to.
Ravka can't endure another power grab, another coup, another war.
Nikolai is insufferable, but he's the only option we have.
He's a good king, Jenya said. I know the difference. Bring him back to us whole.
I will, Zoya promised, though she didn't know if it was a promise she could keep.
And be careful, Zoya. Ravka needs you, too.
Zoya felt a suspicious prickling behind her eyes and hurried out the door before the situation became more maudlin than she could abide. They traveled in luxury, surrounded by outriders and soldiers who carried the double eagle flag. Yuri was kept in the coach, sequestered with Tolia as they scoured old scrolls and religious texts for information on the Obispaya. Another coach had been devoted to the books they'd gathered from the libraries at the Grand Palace and the Little Palace, and a few Tamar had obtained by stealth from the catacombs of the Priest Guard. Scholarly treatises, bound in leather, crumbling hymnals, even old children's books, illustrations of what might have been a thornwood curling at the borders of their yellowing pages. Though Yuri had wrung his hands and protested in querulous tones, he had been convinced to set aside his black robes for the brown roughspun of an ordinary monk so he could travel with them anonymously. He'd given in readily enough. Yuri believed that the secret agenda of this trip, the visits to the miracle sites and the fold, was to determine whether the Starless One should be made a saint, and a church built on the site of his martyrdom.
But for that to happen, Nikolai had warned, I need to know everything you can determine about the Obispaya. The ritual, the location of the thornwood, this whole notion of purification.
Yuri's eyes had lit at that last word.
Purification, he'd repeated. A return to true belief. The faith of the people restored.
Zoya knew Nikolai hoped the monk's research would lead them to a ritual that might purge him of the monster. But even if they were somehow successful, she had to wonder where all of it would end.
What are you going to do with him when this is over? She'd ask Nikolai. The people will revolt outright if you actually try to make the Darkling a saint. You could start a holy war and give the Apparat the perfect chance to challenge you outright. And he'll do it beneath Alina's banner.
We'll find a way to compromise, Nikolai had said. We'll set Yuri up in a nice snug hermitage to prepare a treatise on the Darkling's good works with all the books he wants. We'll tell him the matter has to be put before the people. We'll send him to the Wandering Isle to spread the gospel of the Starless One. That sounds suspiciously like exile. You say exile, I say extended holiday.
We should send him to Ketterdam to preach to Kaz Brekker and the rest of those reprobates, suggested Zoya.
Nikolai winced.
He'd certainly get his martyrdom.
The king hadn't toured the country since immediately after the Darkling had been vanquished, when he'd stepped into the gap left by his exiled parents and onto the throne. Instead of remaining in the capital as the aristocracy had expected, Nikolai had taken to the roads and the skies, traveling without rest. Zoya had barely known the king then, and she certainly hadn't trusted him. She'd understood that he was their fractured country's best hope of survival. And she could admit that he'd shown ingenuity during the Civil War, but he was also a Lansov. And his father had brought nothing but misery to Ravka. For all Zoya knew at the time, the new king might be little more than a handsome, fast-talking catastrophe in the making. But Nikolai had done what so many men had failed to do. He'd surprised her. He had shored up Ravka's borders, negotiated new loans with Kerch, re-established their military outposts, and used the fleet he'd built in his secret life as the privateer Sturmhund to keep the Fjärden stymied at sea. He had visited cities and towns, distributing food, talking to local leaders and nobility, marshaling every ounce of his appeal to win their support and cement public opinion in his favor after the destruction of the fold. When he had finally returned to Olsalta, he had created a new flag with the sun in ascendance behind the Lansov double eagle and had been crowned by the Apparat in the newly built royal chapel. Zoya had felt the stirrings of what might have been hope. She had been hard at work with the Triumvirate, trying to reassemble the Second Army and make a plan for its future. Some days Zoya had felt proud and full of excitement, but on others, she'd felt like a child masquerading as a leader. It had been harrowing, thrilling, to know that they were all standing at the precipice of something new. But now, as they traveled from town to town, Zoya understood that the task of unifying Ravka and building a new foundation for the Second Army had been the easy part. Dragging the country into the future was proving harder. Nikolai had spent his life waiting to govern and learning how to do it. But while Nikolai craved change, Ravka fought it. His reforms to the tithing and land ownership laws had led to grumbling among the nobility.
Of course the serfs should have rights, they protested. Eventually.
The king went too far and moved too fast. Zoya knew Nikolai was aware of the resistance that had grown up against him, and he intended to use this trip to help defeat it. The days were given to travel and winning the commoners through spectacle and gifts of coin or food. In the evenings, their party took up lodging in the homes of noblemen and local governors and joined grand dinners that went late into the night. After the meals, Nikolai would sequester himself with the head of the house, talking through reforms, requesting aid, smoothing feathers ruffled by the peril of change. Sometimes Nikolai would ask Zoya to join them when all she wanted was to fall into bed.
Why should I bother? She grumbled at Baron Levkin's dacha and Kalink. Your charm is enough to carry the day.
They need to see my general, he said. It was true enough. The nobles still thrilled to tales of warfare and the strength of the Second Army. But Zoya also knew that her presence, tart-tongued and sour as it might be, changed the atmosphere in the room, made the conversation seem less a negotiation than a friendly exchange. It was another reason Nikolai desperately needed a queen.
So she did her best to paste a smile on her face and be pleasant, and occasionally offered a word regarding the Grisha forces, if anyone thought to ask. It exhausted her.
How do you do it?
She spat at Nikolai one night, as they left a particularly productive session with a duke in Grevyakin. He'd begun the conversation determined to reject Nikolai's suggestion to use his fields for cotton farming, calling for a return to the old ways. His entire home was full of peasant woodcrafts and hand-woven textiles, the props of a simpler time in which a serf might be counted upon to create pretty objects for his master and politely starve in silence. But 2 hours and several glasses of strong spirits later, the old duke was roaring with laughter at Nikolai's jokes and had agreed to convert 2 more of his farms to cotton. Another hour gone, and he promised to allow a new mill and cotton gin to be built on his property.
How do you change their minds and make them thank you for the experience?
Nikolai shrugged.
He has a noble's disdain for commerce, but likes the idea of himself as a great benefactor. So I simply pointed out that, with all of the time and money his workers will save, they'll have more hours to devote to the ornament he loves so much. His estate might become a beacon for artists and craftsmen, the new world sustaining the old instead of replacing it.
Do you really believe that?
Not at all. His serfs will get a taste of money and education and start thinking about building lives and businesses of their own instead of praying for their master's patronage. But by then it will be too late. Progress is a river. It cannot be called back once it leaps its banks.
That wasn't what I meant anyway, Zoya said as Tolia led them to the chambers where Nikolai would be lodging.
How do you do this?
She waved a hand from the crown of his golden head to his perfectly polished boots.
Days on the road, bare hours of sleep.
She dropped her voice to a whisper.
Being drugged every night, and playing host to some kind of immortal evil inside you. But still you managed to look fresh and contented. I bet if the Duke had asked, you could have spent another hour playing cards and telling war stories.
That's what the job requires, Zoya. Ruling is not just about military victories. It's not even about setting fair laws and seeing them enforced. It's about these moments. The men and women who choose to put their lives and livelihoods in our hands.
Just admit that you need to be loved as much as they need to love you.
Luckily, I'm very lovable.
Less so by the moment. You don't look remotely fatigued. It's not normal.
I think fatigue suits you, Zoya. The pallor, the shadows beneath your eyes, you look like a heroine in a novel.
I look like a woman about to step on your foot.
Now, now. You're managing remarkably well. And the smiling hasn't killed you yet.
Yet.
Tamar was waiting at the door to Nikolai's rooms.
Any trouble tonight? Nikolai asked her.
At their previous stop, Tamar had caught a servant skulking about the king's chambers and digging through his belongings, presumably on his master's orders.
Nothing, she said. But I'll do another search of the house, just in case, and have a look inside the duke's study later tonight.
The old duke seemed to have been won over. But if he'd had contact with Nikolai's opponents in West Ravka, or with one of the Lansov pretenders, they needed to know. Once Nikolai had removed his boots and settled on the bed beneath a grotesque painting of Sancta Anastasia, curing the wasting plague, Zoya pulled the tiny bottle from her pocket. Nikolai shuddered.
Whatever David and Jenya concocted, it feels less like sleep than being punched in the jaw.
Zoya said nothing. The sedatives they'd given him in the past had been simple potions that had made him softly blurry and often left him snoring before Zoya had departed the room. But with this new brew, Nikolai dropped into unconsciousness in the space of a breath, and he did not look like he was sleeping. His stillness was so complete she found herself pressing her fingers to the hollow beneath his jaw, seeking out the molasses slow beat of his pulse. Dosing him was like watching him die every night.
All I know is it's strong enough to shut you up, she said.
She raised the bottle but kept it just out of reach.
Tell me how you manage it,
How do you survive all of this glad-handing and unending performance?
You manage it every day at the Little Palace, Zoya. For all your bluster, I know you don't always feel clever or strong. But you make a good show of it.